Bolton sort of remembers.
On top of Old Smoky, where nobody goes, there lives Christine Keeler without any clothes. Up comes Profumo, clickety-click, pulls down his trousers and whips out his... That was the first piece of satire I ever performed. It was taught to me by Colin Harper, I think, and we sang it in the infant's playground, and we were about 8 years old. I suppose we didn't understand what the song meant, but we guessed it was rude because Miss Metcalf escorted us from the playground. But I certainly didn't understand the intricacies of the Profumo crisis. The only thing I did know was that there were lots of nude photographs of Christine Keeler in the newspapers, and that for some reason she didn't seem to know the right way round to sit on a chair. But that witty little ditty was the first time that I realised that there were these creatures called politicians who people like to laugh at and about. All right, I've just ended a sentence with two prepositions on Radio 4. That's professional suicide. The online petition's starting up even as I speak, and the Twitter storm. Hashtag Andy Grammar Rapist. I've lost my place now. Oh, yeah. Politicians. I'm reminiscing about them because this week my sort of memories concern politics, starting with Profumo in 1963. Now, for younger listeners... Sorry. It's just a funny idea. For anyone who doesn't know or doesn't remember, John Profumo was Secretary of State for War, and he resigned after he admitted lying to Parliament. Because in 1963, politicians who were caught lying were expected to resign. I know, things were so quaint back then, weren't they? Anyway, because Profumo was deemed to have morally disgraced himself, he decided to completely withdraw from public life. Now he'd go straight into I'm a Celebrity, get me out of here, wouldn't he? Yeah, and then he'd do one of those long TV interviews with Piers Morgan, you know, all about how he had to struggle with his demons. You know, everyone's got demons now. Have you noticed? Of course, there was a time when if someone talked about having demons, they'd have been burnt at the stake. I mean, obviously, I'm not advocating that in all cases. Maybe just Alistair Campbell. It seems a hell of a long way, doesn't it, from, say, John Profumo to Neil and Christine Hamilton. Incidentally, listeners, I do apologise for mentioning Neil and Christine Hamilton if you've just eaten. Okay. But no, I'll try and give you a proper warning if I'm going to mention them again, or indeed any other human emetics. Profumo dedicated the rest of his life to charity work, and the contrast between the dignity of Profumo and, say,
warning,
Neil Hamilton, marks one of the big changes in the years that I've been writing about politicians. You know, the downgrading of shame to the point where public disgrace can... Well, basically, it's a great career move. Now, before I proceed, I have a confession to make at this point, because politicians may have ruined a lot of your lives, but they've been quite good to me. I've done reasonably well out of them. You know, if you add it all up over the years since 1976, I've received significant amounts of money for jokes about, you know, Brown, Blair, Major, Callaghan, Cameron, Thatcher. Well, yeah, Thatcher, I mean, I wrote thousands of jokes about the Iron Lady, or as we call her in our house, the upstairs bathroom. Had it done in blue as a thank you, no. Now, I'm sure that some of you are thinking that as someone who just writes jokes and mocks from the sidelines, I can't have played any significant role in the politics of this country. Well, you'd be wrong, okay? Because it just so happens that I occupy a totally unique place in British political history that I will tell you about at the end of the show. Yeah, that's called a cliffhanger, that is. So, when did my interest in politics really start to take root? Well, in my teens, most of my mates were left-wing, and I was too. How left-wing was I? Well, I wasn't left-wing enough to attend demos in Grosvenor Square, but I was left-wing enough to argue with my dad. Yeah, that was my contribution to the revolution. And my dad was a working-class Tory, and a fan of one of the more controversial figures of the age, Enoch Powell. Now, for those of you too young to remember Enoch Powell, he was basically Nigel Farage, only with Latin. Yeah, Powell prided himself on being a classicist, so whenever he wanted to be racist, he quoted Virgil, didn't he? not the Thunderbird. Now, my dad rated Enoch Powell. Very clever man, Andrew. That's what he'd tell me. And one day, we had a blazing row about Powell and politics, and I said that as soon as I was old enough to vote, I'd be voting Labour. And the row got even more heated, and then my dad said, "Your lot won't be happy till someone like me is hanging from a lamppost." And I said, "You're right." And we had a lamppost outside the house. And I said, "That one there, that's your lamppost. It's got your name on it. I've booked you in." Yeah. And my dad, he looked a bit taken aback. Understandably so, because that was a terrible thing for me to say to anyone. And it was only much later in my life that I realised, to my shame, that Dad had actually witnessed people being strung up during his 5 years as a prisoner of war. So it was not my finest hour. But I was 14. I was young and stupid. And when you're 14, you just say stuff. You haven't yet learnt how to shudder. But my engagement with politics went a little bit beyond threatening family members with execution. Partly it expressed itself through an interest in satirical comedy. And in 1976, I found myself, at the suggestion of a marvellous young producer called Geoffrey Perkins, submitting sketches to Radio 4's Weekending. And I've now spent 40 years trying to find the comedy in how terrible things have become. And in that time, I've been repeatedly asked whether satire can make a difference. And the answer is yes. Yes, it can. It can make things worse. Right? In 1979, Alistair Beaton and I decided to write a funny book about our newly elected Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher. We thought we'd better do it quickly because she clearly wasn't going to last long. That's how shrewd we were as political observers. So anyway, the book was called The Thatcher Papers, and it purported to be a leak from deep inside the Death Star of the Thatcher government. And we wrote a supposed Tory campaign poster, which showed a picture of an emaciated-looking Asian child, a bit like you used to see on the old Oxfam posters, you know. And the caption we wrote said, "This is Asif. He lives in Bangladesh in total poverty. He gets hardly any food to eat. Tough luck, Asif." Now, Alistair and I saw this as a dark, savage, satirical indictment of the government's racism. Unfortunately, what the National Front saw was something that would make a great poster. Yeah, because one of the features of neo-Nazis is they're quite literal people. You know, Hitler was notoriously weak on irony. So that is how I inadvertently became the co-author of a white supremacist poster. All right, that's not something you'll find on my CV. And don't add it to my Wikipedia entry. I hate Wikipedia. Do you know that for 6 months on Wikipedia I had no legs? Do you know? It's absolutely true. A mate of my eldest son thought it would be hilarious to say that, you know, because you only see him on panel shows, he's got no legs, and I did. I didn't know because I don't check my Wikipedia page. I was a bit perplexed when theatres kept ringing me up and asking me if I needed a ramp. But anyway. So yes, sometimes when you're writing political comedy, the best intentions can go awry. One of the lowest points of my professional life was while we were making the TV sitcom Drop the Dead Donkey, and I was reading an interview in the paper with the Tory minister, Virginia Bottomley. Again, for younger listeners, Virginia Bottomley was sort of like Theresa May, only without the girlish spontaneity. In this interview, Virginia Bottomley said, to my horror, that Drop the Dead Donkey was her favourite show. And she said this even though in that very week's episode, we had had the character of Dave point out that the name Virginia Bottomley was an anagram of I'm an evil Tory bigot. There's a bloke down there checking it. It is, trust me. Put the pencil away. It honestly is. Now, of course, Virginia may have been lying. She may have wanted to look like a good sport because politicians like to give the impression that they've got a good sense of humour. That's why Theresa May made Boris Foreign Secretary. But whether it was true or not, being bigged up by Virginia made me feel like I needed to go and shower for several months. Okay, so here's the controversial bit where I stick up for politicians. Now, there is a massive general contempt for politicians right now, which seems to date from the MPs' expenses scandal, when MPs were revealed to be making cynical expenses claims. This revelation was made by journalists, all right, many of whom's expense claims could probably win the Booker Prize. Let's be totally honest here. Fiddling or exaggerating expenses is a British tradition as old as Morris dancing, you know. But the tsunami of outrage swept all before it, and it reinvigorated one of our great national catchphrases. They're all the same. With respect to the good people of Britain, that's patently ludicrous to say that a...
Warning.
Neil Hamilton is... It's the same as a Charles Kennedy, for example. I mean, yes, our political system does create problems of groupthink, but that's true in all professions. But you never hear someone say, our toilet's blowing up, but I'm not calling out a plumber because they're all the same. Now, I've had various close-up encounters with politicians, and those have helped me understand that they are just human beings, with the possible exception of...
Warning.
John Redwood. Now, most of these personal encounters with politicians have come through work, but occasionally it's been pure chance. When we had our first baby, Pip, he was a lovely baby, but he went through a phase where he wouldn't sleep, and I'm sure many of you have experienced that madness. It's terrible, isn't it? You're at your wit's end. And we went on holiday to Wales, and we were sitting on the veranda of a lovely country pub, and Pip fell asleep in the pushchair, and it was blissful. You know, it was joyful. We just could feel the relaxation suffusing through our bodies, and we sat there just drinking in the afternoon sun. And a big car pulls up, and out of the car gets our ex-Prime Minister, Jim Callaghan, and his wife, Audrey. And they walk up the steps of the veranda, and they walk past us. Then for some reason, Jim Callaghan reverses, bends down over the pushchair and booms, what a lovely baby. And Pitt woke up and screamed the place down. Yeah. That was nearly the most puzzling assassination in British political history. Yeah. Historians would have argued about that one for decades. They'd have said, well, obviously he was assassinated by the IRA, but why did they beat him to death with a baby's rattle? It makes me angry just thinking about it. Where was I? Oh yeah. None of you will probably want to hear this, but I've witnessed close up some examples of politicians behaving rather impressively. You may remember that in the months after Neil Kinnock's shock defeat to John Major, Kinnock understandably disappeared from public view a bit, and there were dark whisperings in the press about him being a broken man, etc. But then he agreed to come and make an appearance in an episode of Drop the Dead Donkey. Now, on show day, the rehearsal for that particular episode was especially chaotic, but Neil just sat through it, being very gracious and very patient. He was even gracious in the bar after the recording, when he listened very patiently as my dad explained to him all the reasons why he'd lost the election. But there was one moment that sticks in my mind from the dress rehearsal, because that episode was supposed to end with the character of Damien, played by Stephen Tompkinson, punching a female journalist. And then Neil Kinnock was supposed to dive in and grapple with him. But in the rehearsal, Neil grabbed Stephen before he could throw the punch. So we asked Neil not to be so quick off the mark. And he said, "No, I'm sorry, but I could never knowingly stand by and watch a man punch a woman. With one obvious exception." In the last 40 years, changes in society have changed our politics. For instance, there was a time, not that long ago, when the TV news only came on at lunchtime, and then at 6, and then at 9 or 10 o'clock, depending on the channel. Personally, I used to watch ITV's news at 10, if only for the nail-biting excitement of seeing whether Reggie Bosanquet would make it to the end of a sentence. See, that's another thing I miss. Newsreaders who are pissed. I mean, but now, not only are our newsreaders disappointingly sober, they're also constantly on, aren't they? They're on 24 hours every day, scaring the crap out of us. And while they're scaring the crap out of us, an even scarier bit of news is scrolling along the screen beneath them, isn't it? So 24-hour news created 24-hour politics, where modern politicians compulsively seek to achieve something called controlling the narrative. And we are the victims of this compulsion, because it has cheapened and demeaned public discourse, and I blame Tony Blair. That's my default setting for most things now. If in doubt, blame Tony Blair, or the loft extension, as he's known in my house. Now, I have a confession to make here. I voted for Tony Blair in that first election against John Major. I thought that Tony Blair represented the future, like a lot of people then. And I remember watching him give his victory address to his supporters. The first words he spoke, as Prime Minister, in fact, you probably remember him on the stairs. And he said, "A new dawn has broken, has it not?" And I thought, uh-oh. It was that religious intonation, you know. And I remember thinking to myself, I hope he hasn't made a mistake here. I hope he hasn't gone and accidentally confused himself with Jesus. And he had. No, it's an easy mistake to make, especially if you're a delusional egomaniac. It's funny. You read lots of analysis pieces about what went wrong for Blair, but the truth was staring us in the face right in the very first sentence he uttered as Prime Minister. But to be fair, there's no doubt he changed our politics, because he was the master of mass intimacy. The first PM to really understand that feelings have become the dominant currency of public conversation. Now, I'm not claiming that back in the 1960s and 70s, the electorate was somehow more intellectual, you know. Ted Heath was mocked because of his yo-yo shoulders, or because he was a bachelor in invisible inverted commas, and Dennis Healy was distilled to a pair of eyebrows, and Harold Wilson was an untrustworthy man in a Mac, and Michael Foote was a scruff in a donkey jacket, although it wasn't actually a donkey jacket. But our attention spans had not yet become so short that an entire election could be reduced to tiny sound bites and a bacon sandwich. Now, when I started writing in 76, the public mood was very much set by the popular press. If anything, that's worse now. In fact, it's got to the stage where maybe we should just let Murdoch and Paul Dacre draft our laws and cut out the middleman. My favourite satirical joke of the last 40 years remains, how do you confuse a Daily Mail reader? Tell him that the natural diet of asylum seekers is paedophiles. Yeah, I didn't write that. I wish I had. Other jokes I wish I'd written? Nick Revel wrote a great joke. He said that John Major had had a tragic childhood because as a child, he was someone else's imaginary friend. But, the fear of the gaffe, the Twitter storm, the online petition, or the disastrous photo op, whatever, has made modern politics much more risk-averse and boring than when I started writing. There used to be a gallery of chaotic, flamboyant, eccentric figures like Quentin Hogg, the perpetually tired and emotional George Brown, Norman St. John Stevens, Michael Heseltine, Hugh Jenkins, Anthony Wedgwood Benn, Barbara Castle, the Reverend Ian Paisley, and...
Warning.
Dame Shirley Porter. again, for younger listeners... Dame Shirley Porter was... she was horrible. nowadays, sadly, the nearest thing that our politics has to a personality is Boris Johnson's Mr. Pastry Tribute Act. No, he's the only personality. That's if you ignore Nigel Farage, which is what you should do because it annoys him. there is also Michael Gove... But he's less of a personality and more of a species. So now I seem to have arrived at the present day, and some of you may be expecting me to talk about Brexit, but it is my policy not to do jokes about Brexit because I don't want to jeopardise the negotiations. My memories of the Brexit referendum are, well, I've tried to wipe most of them, but there was one incident that was reported to me. I did find it a bit disturbing. We were working on a highly topical last-minute comedy at the time called Power Monkeys. A lot of it was poking fun at how impossible it would be for Donald Trump to get elected. Sorry, I just spiralled into depression for a minute. Anyway, a few days after the Brexit referendum, one of our cameramen told us this story about how he'd gone into his local and he'd got chatting with a regular who told him that he'd voted Leave. And he said, oh, that's interesting. Why is that? And this chap said, well, you just have to look at the EU's record, you know, how they privatised all our railways and how they shut down so many A&Es and closed down all the libraries. Now, don't get me wrong, I am a firm believer in democracy, you know? No, seriously, yeah. And I think we should do everything we can to encourage people to engage with the democratic process and express their vote in the ballot box. But I also think it's okay to say to some people, you know what, you don't have to vote. Because you haven't really been paying attention, have you? Did you know that political strategists now apparently talk about the need to go after what they call low information voters? Yeah, that low information voters, that's their euphemism for lazy and thick. Of course, if the percentage of low information voters gets too high, then it won't really be worth having elections. Incidentally, I do know that the views I'm expressing will open me up to the charge of elitism. I've often been called elitist. Doesn't bother me. When someone calls me elitist, I just quote Racine at them. Usually shuts them up. If I do it in French. Well, I think I'd better stop there because I'm starting to sound like I've had a few drinks. I got that feeling I've forgotten something. Do you ever get that? I've got that something I said I was going... The cliffhanger! Oh, yeah. Right. This is why I am a unique, totally, totally unique figure in British political history. It's the 1980s, and I've been invited to the House of Commons by the Labour MP, Tom Pendry. He's written a sitcom. He wants my professional opinion. So I'm in the lobby of the House of Commons, and Tom arrives, and he greets me with the traditional House of Commons greeting of, let's go for a drink. So we set off. We're winding through the corridors and cloisters of the Palace of Westminster, and we're walking down this cloister having a chat. It's only two people wide, very narrow. And coming towards us, we see two figures. One, a very tall civil servant carrying a big pile of folders. And next to him, directly in front of me, is the unmistakable figure of our then Prime Minister, Mrs. Margaret Thatcher. And she's walking towards me, and she's carrying her handbag in that unmistakable way. Do you remember she used to... I've never seen a woman carry a handbag like that before or since. You know, she used to carry it with that very straight, ramrod straight arm. Do you remember? Like there was a brick in it. Which there might have been. So anyway, they're walking towards us, and we've got a bit of an impasse because this cloister is only two people wide. So me and Tom step to our left to let them pass, but they've mirrored us. They've stepped to their right, you know. So we do that slightly nervous laugh, and then we compensate, and we step to our right. But again, they step to their left. They've mirrored us again. So we've still got this log jam. So eventually, we all work it out, and we all turn side on, like that, and we just squeeze past each other. And as Mrs. Thatcher squeezes past me, I distinctly hear her say, "Sorry." That makes me... the only person in Britain that Mrs. Thatcher said sorry to. They can never take that away from me. Well, thank you for listening to my sort of memories about politics. Any resemblance to characters living or dead is entirely deliberate. Till the next time, goodbye.
Andy Hamilton Sort of Remembers was written and performed by Andy Hamilton. The producer was Claire Jones. It was a BBC Studios production.